Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
The core message of your book, The Price of Tomorrow, is about whether or not we keep on playing the inflation game, which you suggest is baked into our economic system as a prerequisite, essentially. I mean, you know, you hear the Federal Reserve and central bank say all the time, we have an inflation target. You know, it's not too high, but also not zero. It's got to be a positive number.
Inflation is exactly the same thing as wage deflation. It's the opposite side of the coin. So in other words, to try to create more jobs, you're paying people less in real terms. And you can see the political divide. You can see the haves and the have-nots getting worse and worse and worse, caused by the same thing, with different actors on both sides of the system saying, I'll fix it, without realizing the root cause of the problem. We believe we need inflation.
It is my pleasure to welcome to Yang Speaks, technology entrepreneur extraordinaire, chairman of 8 companies, and the author of The Price of Tomorrow. I think he was formerly one of the top CEOs to follow on Twitter, Mr. Jeff Booth.
Thanks, Andrew. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to meet you. And congratulations on a really, really thoughtful and incisive book. I learned a lot from it. So first, let's fill the listeners in on who the heck you are, what the heck you've done. The sense from reading your book that you spent years on a platform company, BillDirect, that was helping contractors, and it seems like this company was a labor of love for a number of years. But how the heck did you wind up in that position? And how does one even start to become a technology entrepreneur?
That is interesting. Well, I'd say what any entrepreneur does is they take a look at an existing system that they think doesn't provide value to somebody else. And they think they can create a new business by providing value. That's really what I did. I was actually a builder before that technology company.
Wait, stop the press. You were a literal builder?
I was a literal builder. So always an entrepreneur, but I had a building company. I owned a real estate company. And what I realized in the building company, I actually failed to deliver a house on time to people. And I had to put their furniture and storage them up in a hotel. And I was really mad. That I was frustrated that I couldn't do the job I said I could do because the system was so broken. So I set out to change that, and I set out to change that with technology, and that became, it, like you say, a labor of love, creating a platform technology company, similar to Amazon.com throughout the dot-com crisis and everything else in a certain industry. And from
Amazon
that,
Amazon a building.
That's what I set out to do. It didn't end up there in the end. But you can imagine how much you learn along the way. But that is what I set out to do.
So you have a faint Canadian accent, and that's that's where you hail from. Are you there now?
I'm here now, just outside of Vancouver.
Oh, good for you! Beautiful part of the world. If anyone hasn't been. So you built BillDirect for a number of years, and then it had its trials and tribulations. How many years ago was that?
20 years ago now. So started in 1999.
Wow. And what the heck has happened since then?
I've learned a lot about myself, technology, where the world's going, what it means. And one of the things that it kind of into the book, that first technology company, it took $5 million of labor or technology, people building technology for something that is today available for $50 a month. And that, and so it took about 2 years of building that first technology for today, $50 a month. And today's version is way better than what we built at that time. So how fast technology is moving, people just don't realize what that looks like. And our brains don't change that fast. That just gave me, at a high level, a whole bunch of structural change that was happening, and at different levels. And you could create a lot of value. I do create a lot of value even today out of different technology companies. But really, think about what they do, what you do as an entrepreneur. You only win if you're valuable to other people. That's how, and today, the technology that allows you to be more valuable to other people allows you to win at an ever increasing rate. And so that structure, which is deflationary in nature, so it reduces prices and it reduces prices more and more as people vote to use services, is hitting up a structure that we've always lived in, which is an inflationary structure where we essentially try to make prices go up through our lives. And so those two things are incompatible together. And I know you do a lot of work on what the solution is. I have a different version of a solution. But I think we see the world similar in where things are going.
Yeah, we do. This is how we got connected, is we're like book buddies. Because people recommended your book to me, and it is an excellent book, The Price of Tomorrow. And we make similar arguments. We wind up in slightly different places. But your argument was a bit different than mine. And I want to unpack what you just said, because I think it's in many ways the core message of your book. The Price of Tomorrow is about whether or not we keep on playing the inflation game, which you suggest is baked into our economic system as a prerequisite, essentially. I mean, you know, you hear the Federal Reserve and central bank say all the time, we have an inflation target. You know, it's not too high, but also not zero. It's got to be a positive number. And one of the central arguments you make is that, hey, technology is intrinsically deflationary, where we're getting to do things faster, cheaper, more efficiently. It's going to churn up a lot of jobs because a lot of people's jobs are born of various inefficiencies and excess expenses. And so as technology gets better and better, you're going to see prices naturally want to go down in a lot of areas.
And Andrew, one of the things I was really looking forward to coming on your show to do, I think you're really thoughtful in this. And in this type of structural change, it requires really bright people think. And instead of believing we live in a framework that we used to live in and papering over an existing framework, I think it requires critical thought to how do we transition into a world that looks very different. Because if you just follow the track of technology, most of the deflation, it's actually just, if you look at your phone, it's everything on your phone is free. And we celebrate that. Every one of us votes for getting more for less out of our individual time. It's actually why we use technology in a business. We try to make our time more valuable. It's why we use technology personally. We try to make our time more valuable. And we all vote for that every day. And today it's moving at an extraordinary pace, way faster than people know. With an exponential pace, and with AI, robotics, everything else, it's going to accelerate to where people just can't even relate. And so if you follow that path where we're all voting to get more for less, how can the system be designed to work exactly the opposite? Where we all vote with our individual time to increase our time, but we vote collectively to say somebody should control making prices go up for in perpetuity forever.
Well, the argument I made on the presidential trail was this, Jeff, and this is familiar to you, and you make a similar comment in your book, which is that you have a lot of things that are getting cheaper or more available, more plentiful. And then there are a few really big ticket items where prices just go up and up. And unfortunately, those things are making everyone miserable. Those three are housing, education, and healthcare, the big three, where they're just getting more and more expensive, even as technology advances. And in America, it's making everyone very sad because their buying power is staying more or less the same. And then their housing, their education, healthcare costs keep going up. And they're like, what is going on? Why am I so miserable? And then you have in categories like media, clothing, cars to some extent, and most entertainment forms, the prices are staying the same or even going down, or the quality is going up. I think cars are staying about the same price, but the quality has gone up a whole lot. So there are elements where you can see things getting better and you're getting more bang for your buck. But then the big three occupy most of your mind space.
So let's unpack that a little bit more, because I think it's really critical to this discussion. And first, before we unpack it, let's just imagine this. Everything we measure is from an existing system. We don't measure what a new system could look like. We measure an existing system. And it's actually why businesses get trapped in an existing system too. Blockbuster measures how many people come into their stores, and they don't measure how fast Netflix is moving. And then a change in technology changes the game, and all the stores become irrelevant. And instead of thinking about how fast technology is moving, what they do is add candy aisles to their stores, thinking that they'll change things. The same thing we do. Right. So I use that example because it's important that we look at Blockbuster execs and think, how could they miss technology moving so fast? Yet we do it in our lives every day. It's what we do. So we're in a system measuring things, GDP, to always go up. And that system is being manipulated through inflation by printing money to make prices always go up. And so we don't ask the question. So today there's there's more today. When I wrote the book, $250 trillion of global debt to run an $80 trillion global economy. And you would think, could that debt ever be paid back? Probably not. Those are huge numbers. But maybe we find some other industries that we could grow faster. But when you examine it deeper, what you realize is $185 trillion of that $250 trillion of debt came in the last 20 years. And then we fail to recognize that would our houses actually have gone up in value if you didn't stimulate them by $185 trillion globally over the last 20 years? And the answer is simply no. Neither would education, neither would anything else. So now you start to see the problem, and you start to see if somebody controls money and they can constantly control money, then some people win out of that economic equation. And some people lose, and you destroy the free market by doing so.
So this is one of the big arguments you make, which the math, you know, is very compelling, where you say, look, what we've been doing is we've been juicing growth by printing a lot of money, but it's by pumping up debt. And the numbers you just cited are saying that we're not actually getting that much growth for all the debt we're taking out.
It's going into stores of value. It's going into what would you do? What would a rational actor do if you're printing that much money? And what would happen? A rational actor would put more money into real estate to try to get away from that printing. Rational actors would, I need to get into the best schools, and I have more money than those other people, so I need to get into those because it's my only way to get out of the system. And so what you're doing is you're pushing prices up. Rent prices are going up. More and more people are left out. And those people are coming back to the same government, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, the same government saying, we need you to fix this problem. But the problem is a structural problem. And it's not bad people on either side. It's they're both dealing from a structural issue that can't be solved by the same structure. System change can't come from the system that created the problem.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang.
I found this argument really fascinating. And most of it's incontrovertible. Like, you know, we have printed a lot of money. I will say that my sense of why prices have gone up in education and healthcare, it's not just that we've produced a lot of currency. It's that the institutions aren't actually driven to become more efficient, where they're being driven to just make more money. And in both of those industries, if you're a hospital and you decide to ratchet the prices up, then it just gets passed along to consumers who feel like they don't have a choice but to pay because it's not like you have an alternative healthcare system to go to. And the same is true for college tuition, where every year the colleges look up and say, how much are we going to increase the prices by this year? Like, you know, and so that has added up over time. And so when I was making this argument to folks on the trail, it was like, look, these institutions just aren't really price. They're not negotiating on price because they think that you as the consumer don't have a choice. So you're not price sensitive.
Let me jump into that one specifically, because I think it'll change. It might change a whole bunch of people's minds on this thing. Now, remember, our minds, once we believe in something, are hard to change. They're really, so we'll kind of keep on reinforcing our beliefs instead of objectively looking at the facts. But here's a fact. Education's already free. It's already free. It's certification is not. And why we stay in that system is we believe we'll get a better job, higher paying job by staying in that system. But I've hired thousands of people, and I can tell you, the curious driven person that is always learning, that is finding their way to learn. I would hire almost 100 times out of 100 over somebody that just thinks I got an education, now I'm done. And so if with an internet connection, you could learn, you could get to any PhD professor, you could learn anything on any.
It's not just certification though, Jeff, because check it out. Like, I agree with you that, look, I can access the content, the learning.
Yeah.
And you have kids, right?
I have 3 kids. Yeah.
Are they college age?
One's just getting into college, yeah.
Yeah. So if you look at the average 18-year-old as to why they're going to college, here's the sense I have. Most of them could not tell you about all of the different courses that they plan on taking or the professors. They pick a school, one, because of the credentialing you speak of, because everyone will just say, hey, UVA, great school. But there's also the socialization that takes place. And then there's the network that takes place because they'll be friends with all these other UVA grads. And then education in terms of like the book learning and whatnot is somewhere in there, along with like a whole suite of other value adds. So the content, anyone can, you know, probably just go out and buy a textbook, you know, and the rest of it. But it's not just credentialing. It's like this whole suite of other things.
I totally agree with you. And my daughter, it's not just that too. I want to go have fun. right? I want to meet a whole bunch.
Yeah, like some of it's partnering. Some of it's like, I want, you know, like people, some people will go to business school because they're, you know, they're looking to find a partner.
I guess what I'm getting at is a monopoly believes it has power forever and doesn't have to change while technology is moving the other way. And technology has changed the rules of what that looks like. And today, some people are just waking up to that change. And I would say over time, as school prices get higher and higher and higher, and more value accretes to people who can learn on their own, we will see our beliefs will change around school. And as they change around school, they that takes a whole nother industry out of rising prices. Now, we could argue that for...
Jeff, but here's where it gets interesting. Like, I have friends, you probably have some of the same friends, who have been trying to innovate in education for quite some time, saying, you know what, like I can provide the same thing for, you know, have the price. Minerva comes to mind.
Khan Academy
is working on another one. Sorry?
Khan Academy.
Oh, yeah. Khan Academy is like the very high level free-ish one that helps people learn all over the world. And these things have not disrupted college in the way that anyone had imagined, in part because, and again, if you look at your own experience, if I have two boys, they're not college age yet, but I kind of expect them to go to college.
but it's funny that you say that. And by the way, that we could go down this rabbit hole forever because this is a belief change, and I think you're right now. But I would say over time those beliefs change, and they change because the market creates a different way of access.
What happens is you have a handful of really mavericky young people whom I love, who look up and say, "Hey, I don't need like all the fancy buildings and the rest of it. Like I was one. yeah, that could have been you. Yeah. And then you'll have some people who are locked out of the traditional system, or you know, think it's a terrible value, but. For a lot of families, if they have the ability to go, they'll try and send their kids to college because, you know, it's what they did, or it's what all of the kids around their kids are doing, or, a lot of it will be for the social aspect. And so anyway, I don't want to take us too far down a digression here, but I fundamentally agree with on a lot of these things. And I also would agree with you on the fact that a lot of asset values, real estate would be maybe the most prominent, but I would say stock prices would be another. There are various assets that are being inflated in price, in part because we just have so much money in the system.
Well, when you have BlackRock, essentially an agent of the government, buying houses against population, you can see pushing prices up. So they're competing in the open housing market for houses. You can see what's happening. So that concentration of wealth, the more assets you have and the more printing you do, those prices just go up. And then what ends up happening out of that system. So if you think about that system is so, we don't see it because we measure the system. Our daily lives are measuring the system. But food prices go up, asset prices go up, everything else, all the food, and a whole bunch of people. Inflation is exactly the same thing as wage deflation. It's the opposite side of the coin. So in other words, to try to create more jobs, you're paying people less in real terms. And their income and their savings are going down in real terms, and we wonder why we have conflict, growing conflict all over the world. It's caused by that exact same thing, but then people come up to and you can see the political divide. You can see the haves and the have-nots getting worse and worse and worse, caused by the same thing, with different actors on both sides of the system saying, "I'll fix it," without realizing the root cause of the problem.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
So we agree on that fundamental dynamic, which is really, really deep. Where what you're saying is, look, you control the money supply, you produce more money, who wins? People with assets, people who can take advantage of price appreciation, who loses? People who are just trading their labor for money because that money just gets worth less and less over time because they can't buy as much with it.
We completely agree there.
Yeah. And then you believe, and I agree, that this is going to drive political unrest.
look at signposts. They're everywhere.
Yeah. And this was the argument I made running for president. I said, look, Trump is a symptom, not the disease. He's a symptom of an economy that has left millions of people behind, and they're just getting more and more ticked off. It's worse in some of the traditional swing states that Democrats used to win and now are losing, like Ohio and Iowa, Pennsylvania. I think was a toss up, and I think narrowly went blue. So the effects of wage deflation, as you call it, and then I was making an automation argument, but that there are forces that are pushing in the same direction are going to end up driving our politics in various ways.
Keep going though, because I totally agree. And so now we are on one thing people think about is AI. One day we'll have it. One day we won't have it. One day we'll have it. And it doesn't work like that. It's on a trend. And that trend that you're talking about, or robotics, that trend on robotics, or 3D printing, or all of these things, or energy, that trend is further and further. It means most of the deflation is in front of us. And so if it took $185 trillion of stimulus to stop it, then it requires exponentially more over and over and over. To be able to, so what we're seeing now is just the tip of the iceberg of what we will see on this path.
Yes, I will say your book made me want to run out and try and hedge against inflation in any way you can. I just got off the phone with a friend who had just launched an ETF called INFL, which is a hedge against inflation. And he says, hey, we're doing great.
One thing I think inside the argument, because it is a deep thesis. And again, we're measuring a system. So a lot of times we won't even look at this because we don't want it to be true, but it is true. Now inside that, there's a couple of layers to that. We think about inflation measuring off zero. What if the disinflationary power of technology 20 years ago was -1%? That's what the economy is. Your time freed up and you got more and more for less and less. And then what if today it's -5% because technology is moving faster and faster on a trend? So then 2 or 3 or 5% inflation would look like a way bigger theft. It would look like, because all inflation is it is a theft. It's I'm going to steal your money and give it to somebody else. It's Robin Hood in reverse. And I wish that wasn't true, but it is. So what if our actual system underneath is actually getting more and more disinflationary and more inflationary? And so, but we are not measuring it. We're measuring it off zero. Then what would look like inflation of 2% would be a greater conflict to the world.
I hear what you're saying, that the base rate, maybe you look at it as like minus 2%. So then this 2% inflation is like really 4% compounding. So one of the observations you make, which was interesting, we said, look, you have a limited number of options if you are in the situation you are in and you're a government. Number one is austerity. you stop spending money. Number two is you print more money. And then if you're a government, austerity is very unappealing. So your logical thing to do is number two. Number three is redistribution. Which some people listening to this will be very excited by. And I'm for universal basic income. I think there are ways to do it where it's not terribly punitive. And I think that the money that goes into the hands of people at the bottom would end up doing a lot of good, like in very good places. And then there was a fourth option, which is, what was the fourth option?
It typically comes through revolution and war.
Oh, yes, the one, yeah. I forgot. Revolution, yeah. And war. So you said that those. So you can see why a government chooses to print if those are the options. And I think the subtext of your book was that eventually you wind up with a revolution or war. At least that was a suggestion I got.
Yeah, and this is why I wrote the book is I want for anything that doesn't happen. I want a most peaceful reset. I want a system that will work into the future in perpetuity. And so let's look at that. Why don't we examine UBI actually, before we do that, let's start with climate change, right? So there's a bunch of people with a cognitive dissonance that says, so technology is driving prices cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and a lot of that technology is green. We get more for less. Let's use solar energy so it's wanting to make energy prices cheaper, and everything we have is on top of those energy prices. And so you have more, and it's getting cheaper by about 11% per year as it moves into more parts of the industry. So what you could expect, what you could deduct from that is everything is going to get cheaper. But if you live in an inflationary environment where everything has to get more expensive or the entire system collapses, then you have to keep printing money. So you keep us, human beings, as rats on wheels, running faster and faster, needing two jobs, driving back and forth for two jobs to work, faster and faster and faster at an ever-increasing velocity to try to stop that deflationary force to keep the system in check. And that... inflation equals climate change. So, and I know that's a big deal, and I know it's a big, but there is no way to solve climate change through a system that must grow forever on a finite planet, and will debase currency to do it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
There's some really big ideas into this. And kind of why I was talking, why I was looking forward to talking to you is you're thoughtful on a whole bunch of, a okay, we understand the problem. And as an entrepreneur, what I think about is once I understand the problem, all energy should go into what are the best possible solutions out of that. And thinking about, okay, what is a solution? Okay, so now take that and let's take, so UBI essentially, to me, at least right now, on top of an existing system, what it does is says, we're still in an inflationary world, but a whole bunch of people are hurting. We're going to make that go faster by printing more money to hold prices higher and higher and higher so that we get to decide who gets what.
I'm not sure that giving everyone a certain amount of money necessarily then says, and we're going to have everything get more expensive. Because I agree with you, ideally you would have innovations like solar that decrease the decrease the cost of a lot of things. My ideal world of universal basic income is actually very minimalist, where people are getting a certain amount of money. And I've seen this in real life, where some people, if they get a passive income at a certain level, they just hang out in the woods.
Yeah. So that, by the way, that's actually the funny thing that we actually agree on. We agree that technology saves our time, and we could prices would fall, and the world we're measuring is a completely arbitrary world because of printing money. That's where we agree with. And if you actually lowered your time preference and said, what would actually happen? We can't measure that world right now because prices are going up. And when prices keep going up, no matter who makes them go up, and this is actually why it's not a political, I'm not on either side of the aisle or anything else. This is not a political statement. This is a statement for my kids that we need a different system. Otherwise, I think our world burns. And it's not just a US phenomenon. This phenomenon you can see actually going all over the world.
Yeah. The big argument you make in the book, I believe there are a couple of big arguments you make. It's why I enjoyed it so much. But one is that we have to stop being addicted to inflation. We have to start allowing for deflation. But just so much of our system right now is predicated on prices going up a certain amount that if you allow for deflation, and it is true that if you had deflation, it would be seen as a massive policy failure right now.
So to carry that forward, and now what potential? So if you had, there's about $120 trillion globally of negative real interest bonds. And so what ends up happening is, so that's a risk-free rate of all global trade and everything else. And it's not the risk-free rate is negative. So if money is corrupted at the base layer, then you could expect corruption everywhere as a result. And that's what's happening. So as a policy, how could you, let's say we agree, and Andrew Yang's going to try to be president next, how could you say, it's impossible to say, okay, we should go for deflation. Because what allowing deflation would do on a credit-based system is the assets would keep on unwinding. They would keep, because the real debt would explode, and everybody holding the debt, which is largely government and corporations and everybody else and all the people on top, would get, you might as well light a fire because all of the prices would reset and the entire system would collapse and the government would be forced to come in and nationalize banks. And so now that's actually why this is a big deal, because how do you transition from one system that worked for a long time that we believe in, but doesn't work with where we're going as a species, as humanity? How do you transition between systems? And so you need a transmission mechanism to allow that to happen. And that transmission mechanism, that needs to be a global transmission mechanism. It can't be one government, because you couldn't do it as just the US or Euro or Canada and anything else. It needs to be a global phenomenon.
So you don't make this argument that explicitly in your book, though it is included, is that it seemed like you're a huge Bitcoin and cryptocurrency believer and proponent as a result, because you're looking at it saying, look, we have these currencies that are being printed in various ways, and governments are going to keep on succumbing to the incentives that they have. So you need a new currency that they can't do that to. And let's call it Bitcoin. The supply is capped. like even if you wanted to, you couldn't make more.
So Andrew, I've come to that conclusion, and more as a result of research, the book, and everything else, and essentially putting on my entrepreneur hat and going down every rabbit hole possible on what is the best possible path to abundance for humanity. That's really so yes, I become a big Bitcoin proponent, but I could care less about making money on Bitcoin. I could care less. I care about the world in which my children grow up in, and so I know that sounds, and it's going to sound for a lot of your listeners like, you just flip the tables on a system. Now these people have money and everything else, but the system, remember, we can't measure what a system would look like from the system we're in. And so people aren't doing the work on what that system would look like. And that system would look like prices keep coming down lower and lower and lower forever. We believe that economics, and we believe we need inflation. Everybody just unilaterally doesn't question why. So we believe our money must be worth less each year to live in a productive society. It makes no sense, but we believe it. And so it carries on. This allows that change from one system to another. And if a whole bunch of people start engaging in it, and that if you saw how fast that ecosystem is evolving, then it could provide prosperity for a whole bunch of people throughout that. And the system looks different in that. So what the system looks like in that is, as labor is removed, prices fall. As labor is removed, prices fall. And it keeps on. So you can't control pricing by arbitrary changing units and pushing money into some people's pockets at the expense of others. So as labor, if we believe that technology is moving faster and faster, which you and I do, and labor at some time is going to be coming out, we're not going to get net new jobs all over the world, then you must also, advocate for a digitally native currency that allows for deflation. And because that won't come from government, because governments can't do it, because if they said we're all in on Bitcoin, the existing system would collapse. You need a transition mechanism to a new system that allows for abundance. So I understand all sides of the coin of what this looks like, but it needs to be kind of a global system that allows this to happen, and it's that big a deal.
What proportion of cryptocurrency enthusiasts do you think come at it the same way that you do? Because a lot of them, and you just said, it's like, hey, look, I don't care about getting rich on this stuff. Like I'm, but I think a lot of people are in the crypto community in part because they've realized so much appreciation and wealth gains.
So that's, and I think some of those people make other people wanting to learn what it looks like harder. It's why I do what I do, kind of trying to come at it from first principles and really understand kind of where we are in this. And I specifically don't say other cryptocurrencies, because other cryptocurrencies, there's so much noise around them because they can be controlled. They look like a company. So instead of Bitcoin, which is truly decentralized, distributed, why that's important and really important is wealth doesn't mean anything on Bitcoin. You have no more power by having more wealth. And what that means is if you tried to aggregate for control, let's say you tried to control people through your Bitcoin, what that means by control, you'd be giving up your Bitcoin. You'd be lessening your control over time. So it works in an entirely different way than today's world looks. Once you have control, you essentially political lobbying and everything else, and you aggregate more and more control. It looks very different than a system that the way you actually add more Bitcoin in time is providing more value to other people. And what are, and you read this in the book, but we measure economics by scarcity, by value, when it is in fact in scarcity. So the air you breathe, if it was valuable, then it should be the most expensive thing you in your world, because it's your most valuable thing. And if we wanted to create jobs there, we could hire a whole bunch of people to bring us around air oxygen masks. But the only place
I did do that in the mountains once. No, I'm kidding. I was in Colorado in the mountains, and I did buy flavored oxygen at like a 7-Eleven, and it was delicious.
Where it's scarce, you buy it on Everest, and you buy it underwater, and it just kind of proves that point. And what's ending up happening is technology is making more and more things abundant, and this is going to be hard for people that aren't following. Again, I'm at the leading edge of this in artificial intelligence and robotics. I see it.
Most people who listen to me agree that technology is going to come for us all.
Exactly. And so that's that piece. Then most things turn into oxygen.
Yeah. Amen. You know, I mean, there are a lot of entrenched interests that will fight it tooth and nail, to your point, which is like, look, I've got a billion-dollar franchise charging you lots of money for this stuff.
Totally. And why system change rarely comes from the system. System change is imposed through technology, trying to deliver more value to other people. If you just think about what Bitcoin is, and why it's growing on a network effect that fast, and what's happening on that system, you could just look at that's what it is. It's a system change. And why people don't see it is they're doing the same thing they did with the internet in 1996. They're projecting the current use of the internet forward instead of where it'll be.
There are some themes I think that most people are sensing, which is that we have a lot of change in the air. We have a lot of institutions that are going to resist that change, in part because they make a very handsome living in the current situation. There are certain sub-industries where that will not work, where the old company will have to make way for the new. But there are a lot of industries where that's not happening, where you don't see that sort of replacement. And I'm going to call out again education, healthcare, housing as like the three big examples. Another example you could throw in there is politics itself. Like, you're not seeing a lot of dynamism where you have an entrenched duopoly of two parties that have been. And you should know, listening to this, that there's nothing in the Constitution about two parties. It's actually a bit of a nightmare from the perspective of the founders, but it's hard to manufacture change. And so the big theme about how the system can't amend itself and that change has to happen from outside the system, I think makes perfect sense.
Because think about this from, again, I try to say this all the time, inside the system, there are really good people. I would say a really good person trying to advocate for change. We disagree on the solution potentially. And I don't actually disagree that there doesn't need to be a social safety net on the way through on the other side. I would just like that social safety net not to be hidden from me in inflation, pretending to say one thing, because inflation is a hidden theft. So I would rather governments get elected on the truth on a new system, and here's the taxes that need to go, and and people vote for it rather than being hidden from me. But both systems at their base, whether it's Republican or Democrat, require endless more printing. So then everything becomes on top of that system. I believe in the free market. It's not a free market. Like you just said, housing goes up and rent prices go up. It's not a free market when you're distorting that much money, corrupting that much money to make those housing prices go up. It's a function of the system. And so you need a new system, because the system, unfortunately, can't change itself.
So that, I think, was one of the big lessons from The Price of Tomorrow. You're a very practical, constructive, enterprising person, what would you recommend to people listening to this if they want to understand what's going on? I would say your book is excellent and readable, and might be someplace that they want to start. I can sense that you wrote this book really just because you wanted people to have a different lens of the world. Like there was nothing to it other than
I don't need to sell more books.
You're just trying to do good. I can sense it. But one of the lessons I got was like, wow, I should really be thinking about putting savings into things that can't just be inflated away. Was one thing I thought. But like what do you recommend?
So Andrew, I would recommend, and I would never go say go buy Bitcoin for everybody to, but I would recommend people definitely learn about it and why it's important, and not just at their natural response to say this and push it away, or those people are self-promoting and everything else. Understand at a deeper level why it's important. And then if you understand at a deeper level of why it's important, get off zero. And then here's what makes me hopeful, because your next book and what you're talking about, American politics and global politics and all of these things that are coming down the line from the existing system, it's like reading signposts. And if you know where this is going, you can read all of the tea leaves of what's coming next. And so what I would say in that is dig deeper. And then if you understand Bitcoin for what it could be, then earlier people on Bitcoin, just like if you invested in Amazon at $5, will do better. But actually, that's not so. So you have yourself interested in an earlier country advocating for Bitcoin will do better than other countries, and then if you understand the policy around it, and what that means is essentially where we're moving with technology requires a digitally native digital currency that allows for deflation. Every other policy concentrates wealth and privilege faster, and concentrates all control. So if you understand what that is, then you look at the types of opportunities that could allow you to transition in that. And I see only Bitcoin being able to do that. I might be wrong. People need to say, okay, I might be wrong with everything else and do their own research, but that's the only thing that I see doing that. And so why I advocate for it is because it's that important.
You can also follow Jeff Booth. I've been following him and have been learning a lot. Thank you so much, Jeff. And we're going to keep working on this because your kids and my kids aren't going anywhere, and we still have to try and keep this world from burning.
Love that. Love that.